This is the Family Culture Movement. Are you ready to break up with the dysfunctional beliefs and behaviors of our dominant culture and parent with intention? Then you're in the right place. The Family Culture Movement is where you'll learn how to take inventory of the narratives and social conditioning shaping your family dynamics and say no to the dominant culture. I'm your host, Jody Chafee. I'm going to help you break dysfunctional patterns and lead your family with confidence and resilience. Hey, if this is your first time tuning in, be sure to check out the last episode of the Family Culture Movement with Michaela Marsh, where she talked about what it was like to grow up in Scotland with her adopted brother from Africa. Welcome to the show, Jennifer Jarrett. She is a homeschooling mother of three children, ages 11 to 16. She has been homeschooling for 16 years. She and her husband, Kelly, have been married for 22 years. Congratulations. And adopted all three of their children. They and their 16-year-old daughter are white. Their 11-year-old boy-girl twins are black. Jennifer and their family have learned a lot about white privilege and racism living as a mixed race family in America. Welcome, Jennifer. I'm excited to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jody. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us a little more about your experience. What led you to adopting your children?
So when my husband and I first got married, it took us a few months before I convinced him we need to start trying to have children. And then that wasn't working out. And we come to find out that it wasn't going to be possible for us biologically. And so we decided to pursue adoption, and it took a long time, the whole process. I think we'd been married for 5 years before we adopted our oldest, Isabel. And then another 5 years before we were able to adopt our twins. And our twins were born in Utah, and we were in the Seattle area at the time where we live now. And it was a wild, crazy experience. They were born at 25 weeks, so super early and tiny and fragile. And it was just one of those, it was just meant to be, for sure. There were so many miracles that got us there, and they're miracle babies, that they were alive. I mean, they were 1.5 pounds each, crazy sick. And yeah, it was a wild experience. And they were in the NICU for 3 months, and we stayed with my husband's family in Utah, and my husband commuted back and forth for work on like the weekends. And then we finally brought them home. And at first that's what it was all about, was just like, let's get these babies healthy. And it took a while to, like, they weren't even, my little girl wasn't even on the like growth chart curve for like 2 years. Aww. She was so tiny. And, but they got physically healthy, and, things started to go better, and we were having so much fun raising them. And I was learning all about how to do black hair and take care of their skin, 'cause it's totally foreign. And there was a lot to learn about it. And I was having fun doing all that. And so, you know, for a while it was just really fun. And occasionally we would get comments. People were very curious and would be a little bit rude asking, you know, trying to get our whole backstory in, you know, a grocery store conversation.
And to a stranger, like, how's
right. but mostly it was just positive comments. Sometimes our oldest, who's white, felt a little left out because she wasn't a twin and she wasn't black. So she wasn't nearly as noticeable as Aww. These two cute little twins. And, then as they got to be around, I'd say 5 or 6, and they started to go from being adorable, cute little people to like looking more like, you know, going to be teenagers. And now they're 11. And my son's quite tall now. He started out so tiny, but he's really tall for, I mean, he's only 11. He's like 5'4". Oh, wow. Skinny. But yeah, they look older, and they started having different experiences where people were treating them more like threats. Like the worst one was, when my son was 9, he went outside to take the garbage out. You know, we live in a suburban white neighborhood, very white. I had never thought of it as that way before, but it is. There's not very many people of color here. And he walked out to take the garbage out, and a man was jogging past our house and stopped my son. I'm assuming that he thought my son didn't look like he belonged in this neighborhood. And he stopped him and said, "What are you doing? What's your name? What's your address? What are you, you know, why are you here?" And my son was pretty terrified and just ran inside and told me about it. And I never caught the guy I wanted to, but my son was pretty traumatized by that. And I mean, we've been to lots of therapy about it, 'cause he felt like really, you know, unsafe in his own front yard. And that's when I realized, I thought of my neighborhood as this really safe neighborhood. And my oldest, when she was about that age, about 10, we started letting her wander around the neighborhood with friends, and, you know, getting a little bit of independence and freedom. And I realized at that moment, I wasn't going to be able to do that with my black children. It's not safe for them. People think they don't belong here. And especially if they were to call a police officer, it could go really badly. If you know, there's the talk you hear about that, mm-hmm. Black parents have to give their Black children about what to do if you encounter law enforcement. And, we've had to have that talk in the last couple of years, and it's horrible to explain. And especially when you're white and they're saying, do you and Dad and Isabel have to do this? And we say, no, we don't. And they are trying to understand why, and it's totally unfair. And then trying to keep them safe. Like my son would love to wear hoodies all the time. He would like to be hidden up, but that's dangerous for him. We can't let him do that. And he also, like many boys his age, loves weapons and thinks they're fascinating. But we cannot let him play with a water gun outside of our house or anything that looks weapon-like. It's just too dangerous for him. And we talk about it. It probably comes up every single day because he's frustrated by it and trying to looking for ways around this. And
wow.
we're trying to balance, you know, safety with safety with freedom. But
yeah,
in their case, if we're coming more and more to like, we just have to keep safe. And it means you have very little freedom. Like we just can't let them go out of our house without us, especially my son. With my daughter, with the 11-year-old who's Black, if she's with a group of friends in their neighborhood, I feel okay about it. But definitely not my son.
Wow.
And that's hard.
Yeah. So there's just not a lot of, it's just a mostly white neighborhood. Is like,
yeah. I mean, there are whenever we do see a person of color, my kids point it out. Cause it's like, oh, that's so exciting and notable, but right. You can number them.
Yeah. I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood also, and school system, like, you know, mm-hmm. and so I'm, you know, I recognize like now with all of the climate of racism and everything that's going on, it's like, how do I navigate this? Because I just don't have any social background to understand like how to navigate it, how to talk about it. And so basically when you started experiencing this, was this your first like experience with
racism? Yeah, I had no idea that racism was still a really big deal in our country. I thought, you know, there were a few cranky old people who just didn't know what they were talking about, mm-hmm. but I didn't think it was like a real thing that was, but watching the experience my kids are having and comparing it to mine and my husband and our oldest who is white, her experience, it's just totally different. And like another example, with my daughter, she likes to dance and goes to a local dance school where it's great. She loves it there. But, the default for, clothing in the dance world, like the uniform that you wear for recitals and things is, tights that are like pink, or they call them nude color, but they're nude if you're a white person,
right,
like,
right.
You know, it's approximating white skin, and shoes too. And, the first time they told us, this is what you're supposed to wear for the recital. And I looked at it, and Chloe looked at it, and she burst into tears and said, Mom, do I have to wear that? And I said, no, you absolutely do not. And I had to talk to a few people at the studio. The first person I talked to said, well, this has never come up before. All the kids who, you know, with different colored skin have always just worn it. And I'm like, well, mine's not, this is not happening. And then I talked to another teacher who said, that's fine. She can wear whatever she feels comfortable in. And that was good. And we talked about at home, and I think a lot of people might initially think, what's the big deal with the color of the tights? But the message that my daughter was getting is my skin color isn't okay. There's something wrong with it. It needs to be covered up and made to look like white skin. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it just went right to her little soul. Like, it's just a horrible, and like just now, like we're talking 2020, you can start to find shoes and tights in other skin tones in the dance world. But like for years, like Misty Copeland, who's the first Black prima ballerina, in, I think she's the American Ballet Theater, is, she hand dyes her own shoes and has for years because she couldn't buy them in her skin tone.
Wow.
And that's an example of systemic. There's not a person you can point to and blame and say, this person is being racist. This is just the system. The system assumes that most people are white.
Yeah.
And, or it assumes all people are white. And that if they're not, well, then they can just deal with, this is what it is.
Yeah. And it's hard to say that's ignorance on the part of, but it is, it's absolutely ignorance. Like it's assuming that there's only one social group, and that's just wrong. It's just wrong.
Yeah.
There's nothing else to say about it. I mean, it's hard. It's hard when you're in a community where the majority is white, but it's like, you'd hope that they could still be sensitive to the differences, right? Like,
right.
So that's a fascinating, this idea of the system, the systems that, but it's again, it goes back to this concept that when we have, when we're socially conditioned to believe that things are a certain way, like your community, they're just like, well, we're predominantly white, so we don't know what to do.
Right.
It's like when, but then we need to be able to challenge that, like saying,
well, I mean, I think to an extent. To the hardest thing as white people is we don't know what we don't know.
Yes, exactly.
You can't just suddenly say, start thinking about people of color and automatically know what it's like to be a person of color in this world. And so the like, if you want to change the system, you need to get people of color in positions of power where decisions are being made. You need a person of color working at the company making the tights and shoes, because it will occur to them. They will say, hey, we only have pink skin tones here. Can we put in some brown and other skin color tights and shoes? They will think of it. It's not
like appeal to a bigger market. Like,
right.
Yeah.
And so if you get more people of color in charge of things and in writing books and producing movies and all of that, then we will start to see all the different races represented better.
And to help change the discussion and the narrative and the prejudices that people are picking up, thinking just it, that are only picked up because of lack of information.
The only way a white person can know about this stuff is by listening to the stories that people of color are telling. Because we're not having those experiences. We're never going to. It's not going to resonate with us because we're not, that's not our experience. It never will be.
Wow. Wow. So what can we do? What are ways that white people can get more exposure and get more, you know, understanding and compassion and experience?
That's a great question. There's lots. I mean, there's lots and lots of people writing about it today. I think sometimes it's easier. You might be able to connect better with somebody that you feel like, maybe hearing someone like me talk, you might initially, that might be a better starting point for you. There's a great book I really like called White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. She's white. And so she understands what it's like to come from a white perspective. Ultimately, I think the goal would be listening to actual people of color, like reading books by them, but start wherever. If it's easier for you to start with somebody, you know, or that's, you know, or a white person that you're more comfortable with, do that. But then the goal is listen to people of color, and there are tons of them speaking up everywhere. You can find tons of people to follow on social media and books. I have here in my living room, I brought my piles of books with picture books with children of color on the covers. I really like the Read Aloud Revival podcast. And she has lists of books, and she has two lists, one of diverse picture books and one of books to talk about racism. And those are both really, really useful. And there's all sorts of resources out there. So start searching for resources and then listen to the stories. And when your mind says, oh my goodness, couldn't be true? You have to stop yourself and go, it isn't true in my life, but these people are saying it's true. You just have to believe it, even as unbelievable as it sounds.
Yeah. That's where understanding the different constructs and the things that we've been socialized into because of, you know, conditioning and exposure. It's not like we're doing this on purpose to say, oh, well, the races are different and bad or good or whatever.
Right.
It's almost like you just said, we just don't get the exposure to it. And I started reading that White Fragility, and I still have ways to go into it, but just starting to read it, I was like, wow, this is awesome. I'm opening my eyes to a lot, because realizing that when we are only surrounded by white people, and then we're told we're, you know, let's talk about race, the response is, well, I'm not racist, and then getting angry. And then it perpetuates the lack of conversation, actually. You know, it's people who think, well, there's no way I can be racist because, well, I only have experience with white people. You're right. That doesn't make you racist, but not being willing to have a conversation, you know, or shutting out a conversation, that's not okay either.
And I think that's a big thing we have to do as white people, is learn to live with a lot of to sit with discomfort, to not run away with it. These are super uncomfortable topics.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody feels good talking about them, but when you're a person of color, and I'm not, so I can't say that this is what I'm experiencing, but I'm watching my kids have this experience. Race is on their mind all the time because they're constantly surrounded by people that aren't their same race. They can't help but think about it. If you've ever been, like, I once went to a church congregation with my kids that was mostly people of color, and it was so awesome for my kids. I was hyper aware there that I'm the one that sticks out. I'm different. I'm not like all of these people. And that is what my kids experience every single day of their lives. They have gotten used to it, but it's still not comfortable.
Right.
It's, and we just need to get a little bit more okay with being uncomfortable if we're going to help with this?
Well, and to pause, and when we feel that sense of discomfort, question is, where is this coming from? Was this something that was conditioned to me at some point growing up or in a social situation where, oh, this was a discussion that we had and I formed a certain judgment around this? Stop. And before you react, be willing to sit with that question of the discomfort and where it's coming from. And so that you can be like, all right, I recognize the discomfort. Now be open and willing to have a conversation to figure out where did that discomfort stem from? Or at least,
and I think
get over
recognizing,
it.
Yeah,
get over
this discomfort isn't going to, there isn't a thing you're going to be able to say or do that's going to make it go away.
Right.
Once
right.
you open that Pandora's box, it's just open, and you just kind of, you confront it over and over and over again, but you can feel peace knowing I see it now and I'm trying to help make it not so.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. So that's cool. So one, you say we should read books, start where you're comfortable. If you want to read a book by a white person that's more comfortable for you, fine. The goal, I think, would be to empower people of color to share their stories, share their messages, and to contribute to, you know, the narratives and the norms that we're seeing in society and in the marketplace and all these different things. So what else can we do for our children? On top of, you know, reading these stories, or if we come into a situation that where they start feeling discomfort, what is some of the dialogue or conversation that you have with your kids about that?
Yeah, that's a good one. And like in my family, race came up very early naturally because we have a mixed race family. In most white families, it's not going to come up. So you can introduce it by making sure that your house has books with children of color. There's tons of beautiful picture books that do that. And they don't even have to be a book about race, but like making sure your kids are seeing there's lots of different ways that people look in this world. And your kids are going to ask questions. They're going to bring it up. They notice things. They see stuff. And when they do, then you don't shy away from it. Have an honest conversation. Especially as they go, they're going to ask their own questions, but you try to be the first one to introduce them to the idea of race and tell them what you believe about it. Like you can say race is a social, I mean, you're not probably going to say it's a social construct to a 5-year-old,
but what's that?
race is just the way that people sort people in this world based on how they look. It is kind of made up and it's sort of silly sometimes the way people treat each other because of race. But we need to know that this is real and this happens in our world. And if you have a friend, like if you have anybody in your life that is a person of color, you can point that out to your child and just alert them to the idea that that person that you love and know is having a different experience in this world than they are.
Wow.
Like I, like mothers of my children's friends, I ask them to teach their kids to stay with my kid if there's ever an authority figure that approaches them, because that could be a really dangerous moment for my child. And so don't run away from them. Don't, you know, just be, I mean, they're rarely away from me because it's so dangerous, but that's a thing you can do. Teach your kids to stand with your friends of color and just be physically present if anything's ever happening.
Wow. I love that. So that leads into this idea of how we can advocate with people of color. And, you know, 'cause it's like, you say you recognize that there is some privilege that you enjoy that your children don't.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, but that's kind of a reality. And then there's also this like white savior idea that you're just like, well, we don't want that either.
Right.
But where is the middle ground of being able to say, look, I want to help and advocate for you?
Yeah. I'm trying to navigate that myself. I definitely don't have all the answers and I still have way more to learn, but what I've learned so far, what I think is the right is I'm trying to, as often as possible, turn people towards people of color for the story, like go there to hear the information, try to listen to them and hear what they're saying and then believe them. And then we stand with them silently. We try not to center ourselves and make it about us. Mm. We try to just be an ally standing with them and letting them doing the talking and the teaching and everything else like that. We never try to say, I know how to fix your problem.
Right.
We have to, even if that thought is coming to your mind, you have to stop and say, okay, if they could have fixed this problem by now, would they not have done so? There's probably something in their way getting in there, you know, preventing them from solving this problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I watched this one lady that was like, white people need to stand up and support blacks and, you know, we need to be, the help them solve this problem, right? I mean, is that real? Is that what we should do? Or is that...
We need, I mean, like, I do think if you see a Black person leading a cause saying, hey, this is what we need to do, this will, like, listen to them. If you can at all agree with what they're saying, then get in line behind them and support what they're doing. Yeah. Join their causes. Don't start your own that competes with it. Join their causes.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think that we should, you know, try to follow them and let them lead on this and support them and recognize that we're going to make mistakes too. And it's going to be awkward and uncomfortable, and that's okay. That's being human.
Yeah.
Figure it out. I've made so many mistakes. I'm sure I've offended lots of people in the past without meaning to. And that's another idea that I've learned a lot, is this idea of intent versus impact. Mm. Because if we focus on our intent, there are very few people in this country who intend to harm people of color or keep them oppressed. That's not really, I mean, I think there probably are a few really horrible people in the world who have that intent, but I do not think that's the majority of people. But if we keep the conversation focused on intent, we never deal with the impact. And the impact is that our society is racist systemically, and people of color are not safe here and are having a very painful, different experience. That's the impact. So we have to stop talking about, I didn't mean to, and that's not my intent,
right,
and look at what's happening and why, and how can we undo it?
Ooh, I love that. I love that. So it's really just, okay, it wasn't your intention. Let's have a conversation about how it is impacting. Wow. I love that. That's so cool. And I love this conversation. You know, you feel like having more conversations like this is going to help lead to more anti-racism, you know, people who are supporting, you know, like that I feel like is the goal. I mean, I mean, it's two white people here talking about this, but,
right.
But you know, I just think that, again, like you said, if people are more comfortable, if they want to pick up a book written by a white person, they want to listen to a podcast talking to a white person, if that helps you to make the transition to listening and accepting your constructs and the narratives that are leading you to discomfort and understanding them, then okay, fine. Let's be that segue, but don't stop there. Don't stop there. That's really, that's what we want to advocate. Right. Awesome. Oh my goodness. So Jennifer, thank you so much for being here. I love this conversation. And, maybe people can connect with you and be friends with you on Facebook. Is that?
Yeah, I don't.
That's usually what I do.
Yeah,
I'm like, what's your website? Oh wait.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I have a blog that I post on like every now and then. I blogged a little bit more during pandemic, but not very recently. Yeah. That's mavenhood.blogger.com. And then, but on Facebook, I'm Jennifer Jarrett.
Awesome.
You probably can find me there.
Well, I really appreciate you being willing to come on and have this conversation and, you know, being a part of this movement. I really am passionate about, you know, just starting conversations and starting to recognize and ask disruptive questions about the things that we think are normal and it's not, or, you know, things like that. You know, it's only normal to us, but we need to be able to recognize other people's norms and learn how to be accepting and appreciative of those. So
I really appreciate the work you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to be part of it. And I've been listening to episodes of your podcast, and there's lots of really, really great stuff in there. And
good.
I appreciate the work you're trying to do.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for being on the show.
Okay. You're welcome.
Glad you were able to tune in for this episode of the Family Culture Movement. Don't miss the next episode with Ternice Bryant, when we discuss the importance of changing systemic racism.
Again, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Family Culture Movement. Help more people find the show. Download this episode, subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave a review. For more tools for shaping your intentional family culture, be sure to sign up for your free membership of the Family Success Toolbox at homeandfamilyculture.com. Until next time, remember to set your intentions for your family culture and lead your family toward your vision of success.